Doesn't that make you crazy? All right. So we are about ready for a gentleman who has been a stalwart of our movement for years, and we are apparently leaving things in his way. Good. I'm glad it wasn't you. He is the editor of the Braille Monitor, but he has served the National Federation in so many different ways. For a long while, he was on the board of directors, and we're always glad when he can be with the board. I know the board values his input. When we turned 50, when our affiliate turned 50, he came and he was our national rep, and he was so fascinating. We were all so interested that we really didn't want him to stop talking, but he did. And he's waited 9 years to come back. So we'd like to welcome our national representative, the editor of the Braille Monitor, Mr. Gary Wunder.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I will. I'll set it up here. Hopefully that's a loud enough volume. Yeah. I'm sure after a while you'll think it's a loud enough. Ooh, what's the Braille note here?
Oh,
my gosh. Dear Gary, as you consider how long to make your speech, please remember some of us have undiagnosed non-24. Others of us have guide dogs that need to be taken out at least every 4 hours. The bottom line is, keep it short. Love, Jessica Schneider. Jessica, that brings me down a little bit, I gotta tell you. But that's okay, because Father John helped me this morning after my national report. He came up and he said, Gary, I just want you to remember that light moves faster than sound. This means some people appear much brighter before they speak. So I don't know what all of that means. So when I was last here in New York, as you just heard, I was able to join you in your 50th anniversary celebration. Many of you were around then. Some of you are new, and you missed hearing about the original blind and sighted people who were responsible for founding and growing what we now enjoy here in New York. How many of you are new, didn't hear that speech? Oh, good. Then I can give it again, and it will be new to you, right? Fair enough. Well, that is exactly right. That's exactly right. Well, when I came into the world, like some of you, I was 3 months too early. I weighed 2 pounds and went down to 1 pound and 14 ounces. So they said goodbye about the same time that they were saying hello, but it didn't work out that way. God had different plans. There was a lot of guilt in my family about the fact that I was born prematurely. It turns out that my mother had been playing a little game of basketball with my father the day before she went into labor. He had thrown the ball to her, and it was high enough that she had to jump for it. So when she realized that she had a child who was born 3 months early, she associated this with that basketball game and felt terrible about playing it at all. My father did the same, feeling that I was born early because he threw a ball too high. My mother died in 2008, but my father still feels guilty about what he views as a stupid mistake. I wish this was a burden that I could take from him, for I have as much reason to believe my early start has given me an advantage as I do to believe it has been a disadvantage. My parents, after having me in the hospital for about 4 months, brought me home, and they thought that maybe this was the worst of it. Then they realized I wasn't making eye contact or tracking objects. They also thought I slept a lot. They took me to the doctor and got the news. My father tells the story that when he came home from work, he saw my aunt, my grandmother, and my mother, and all of them were crying. They told him what the doctor had said. The boy was certainly blind and most likely retarded. My parents should provide for me, at least for the rest of their lives, and if they could manage to successfully do it financially, they should provide for the rest of my life as well. Think about that. What that would feel like to those of you who are young parents to get that kind of a sentence from the medical community. My father, in telling me this story, said, "Gary, I'd like to tell you I was concerned about you, son, but my original thought was that I am done for. What in the world am I going to do? Here I am, a young husband. We want to have other children. How can any of this be? Do we even have a future?" But the world went along, time passed, and I grew up and started to talk. Like most of you, I learned that the radio was the coolest piece of technology on the planet. This is pre-iPhone, of course. I was considered a child prodigy by the time I was two because I knew all of the hit tunes that made up the 40-star survey, a little countdown of songs each week. Being blind and a child prodigy meant that I was spoiled. All the women in my life, they loved me, and they coddled me, and they thought I could do no wrong. Unfortunately, there were more people in the world than just those women. There were men, and one of them was my father. And he said, "This kid is never going to grow into anybody if you let him have his way all the time and do whatever he wants." Dad was the disciplinarian. Luckily for me, he worked a lot. And as far as I was concerned, the more he worked, the better I liked it. He generally left home at 6 o'clock in the morning and didn't get back until 8 o'clock at night. I couldn't figure it at the time, but that was 14 hours of good living. And if you counted 8 hours for sleeping, I only had to put up with him for 2 hours a day, perhaps a few more on Sunday. But he managed to make his influence felt, and as I grew, I came to have a very different opinion of him, which I'll tell you about later. I got lots of conflicting messages about what it meant to be blind. I expect you did too. I got the message from my folks that you can do anything, and they tried to make that message real for me. For instance, when I wanted to learn to ride a bicycle, they said, "Sure, we'll let you do that." And when I wanted a horse, they said, "Well, if your brothers and your sister are getting one, we'll give you a horse as well." I didn't think anything about that at the time, but I later learned that my grandfather came to my father and said, "This is the most irresponsible thing I have ever seen you do," and that's saying something. "I must have raised a first-class idiot. How could anybody be so stupid? I want you to know that if that boy gets hurt or gets killed riding that bicycle or that horse, I'll be the first one to go to the prosecutor and urge that you be charged with murder, or at least willful neglect." I can't imagine what it was like for my father to endure being called stupid by his father and being told that one accident by me might send him to prison. My grandfather really thought we had all gone over the edge when my dad went out and bought motorcycles for my two brothers. He came home and I said, "There are only two motorcycles here." "Yes, I got one for your brother Jay and one for your brother Mark." I asked, "Well, why aren't there three?" He said, "Because I think your sister is too young to ride one." I replied with as much disgust as fear and respect for the old man would allow. I said, "I wasn't thinking about my sister. I was thinking about me." "Then you're telling me that you want one?" he said. "Yeah." We didn't say duh back in those days. And had I done anything that sounded that much like sarcasm, I'd have ended up on the ground. He said, I thought you told me that you used your ears a lot to ride the bicycle. And you know that a motorcycle makes a lot of noise. It goes faster than what you've been riding. Is this really a smart thing? I confidently said, I think it is. In a very thoughtful and somewhat hesitant voice, he said, well, I'm in no position to judge. You're 14 years old. You're smart to decide whether you can do this or not. If you think you can, we'll get you a motorcycle. And he did. Wow. Now, I didn't have a big motorcycle. It was a 50cc engine, not much of a motor. A two-cycle engine that you had to mix oil and gas together with. It didn't sound very much like the big cycles you hear today. It sounded a lot like a small chainsaw. But without bragging, let me tell you, it was a Harley Davidson. But no matter how small the engine, I rode that thing. It was cool, and I thought I was cool. Sometimes the people I was following weren't sure cool was the word to describe me when they slowed down or stopped without saying, and I rammed them from behind. With the sound of my motor, it was difficult to hear their motor if it dropped in pitch or in amplitude. So stop became a very important word. So those were the positive messages and life experiences that said blindness was okay and I could do anything. I got to do a lot of things as a kid that made me believe that I had some capability. But there were other messages that I got that weren't quite so good about being blind. There was my grandmother, one of those women who loved to spoil me, and I dearly loved her for doing it. She would say things like, "You are smart. I think you can do almost anything. Maybe you can talk on the radio. You already know all those record people and the songs they sing, so maybe you can be a disc jockey. Why, I bet you can be a preacher because you read the Bible and you certainly talk a blue streak. You know, the good ones get paid pretty well." She was talking about the Protestants, of course. "Maybe one day, if you really work at it, you can be a lawyer, you know, like Perry Mason." Now, I thought this last idea was pretty good because I watched Perry Mason on television, and from what I could tell, he only worked one day a week, and then only 26 weeks a year, the rest being reruns. That seemed like a pretty good job to me. But then my grandma went on to say, "Now, of course, you are blind, and therefore the welfare will have to come in every day, and they'll make sure you brush your teeth and wash your face and make sure you're presentable to go out into the world." Whatever confidence she had transmitted before was overshadowed by the fact that I would forever be involved with the welfare. No one in my family would be supervised like that. Adults didn't have to be managed in this way. And it made me sick to think that I might be so limited. After my initial shock, I tried to use my rational brain to separate fact from foolishness. I did not need the welfare to remind me to brush my teeth. Only little children had to be reminded to wash their face. I told myself that I should shrug it off and go on my way, separating, as one always must, the good advice from the bad. You can imagine how it felt when, one day before I went off to school, I quickly washed my face and brushed my teeth. Unbeknownst to me, I left the toothpaste on my lips. And when I was told, I knew there and then that my grandmother had been right, that I had overestimated my ability to be independent and self-sufficient. Sight was indispensable for being and looking normal. I had to stop pretending, had to learn to be realistic, and had to realize that no matter my other assets, I had real limitations and might really need that governmental intervention and supervision. Now, once I got past the emotion of all of that, the power of grandmothers to influence the child, the confidence problems that children normally have anyway, eventually I realized that part of any reasonable person's routine should be to brush one's teeth and then wash one's face. The mechanics eventually become obvious, but regaining the emotional confidence that goes along with that rational evidence really took me some time and some faith and some willingness to risk believing in myself once again. I can't say that coming to believe that I could go forth with a clean face was the hardest thing I've ever done, but it was hard enough that I remember it, and hard enough that it makes me sympathetic when other people tell me they can't do things I know full well they can. I was often disturbed by my parents' reactions to blind people they saw on the streets. If they saw a blind man walking down the sidewalk with a cane or a dog, they would say, "Well, I wonder if he's going to be okay. I wonder what he's doing out alone. I wonder if he knows that there's a big street up here that he's going to have to cross." They were obviously afraid for him. Not afraid enough to stop and help, but afraid of what it was like for him to be blind. I grew up with the idea that they were comfortable with me as a blind kid, but not at all comfortable with the idea that I would grow up to be a blind man. So, not surprisingly, neither was I completely comfortable with growing up to be a blind man. If you were a blind child, I'm sure your parents offered you a lot of hope about the future in the same way mine did. We have probably all been told as children that soon we would see. In my day it was, if we can send a man to the moon, certainly by the time you turn 16 there will be a way for you to drive a car. That message sounded pretty good when I was 7. It sounded pretty good when I was 10. I started to have some doubts at about 12. At 14, I thought this was a little too optimistic. And at 16, I was pretty darn disappointed because it didn't happen. The magic age that meant so much to others meant little to me. Part of the hope, part of the fantasy, and part of the denial was that I would not grow up to be a blind man. But as certain as night follows day, blind boys turn into blind men. And now I'm smart enough to thank God that they do. The biggest problem I had when I was growing up was that I didn't have many positive blind role models. We were in a small town and didn't really work to find and associate with other blind people. The teachers in my elementary resource room who worked with my parents discouraged it. Too much association with blind people would be unhealthy for a young blind boy who was going to have to grow up in a sighted world. Still, I did know some blind folks. I knew an older blind man in my town named Hawkey. I don't know how he got the nickname, but that was it. He was renowned in my community of 216 people because he had come up with this ingenious technique for delivering the mail to his less mobile neighbors. He could travel enough with a cane to go to the small post office. But the thing that so amazed people was that he could keep their mail separate from his own and unerringly get it to the people to whom it belonged. So what was this great technique that he had invented that so awed our community? Well, he'd take his mail and put it between his thumb and his first finger. The first neighbor's mail between fingers 1 and 2, and the next neighbor's mail between fingers 2 and 3, and so on. You get the idea. Now, the more people bragged about that technique, the more I got the impression that this was the low expectation that would be held for me. I mean, I was glad that he did a good turn for his neighbors, but I didn't think it was the most inventive technique in the world to use the fingers of your hand to separate the mail. So my buddy Hawkey was a fellow I liked a lot, but I did not want to grow up to be like him. People loved to drop by his house and talk with him, but that was the extent of what he did, that and listen to the radio. He was the guy who knew all about sports, the fellow who listened to all the town gossip from passers-by, and the fellow who relayed and embellished it religiously. He was somebody I was happy to visit and respect, but I wanted to be like my father. I wanted to be a mover and a shaker, a person who said serious things about serious things. Until I met the Federation, I didn't know a blind person could do that and be taken seriously. I had ham radio buddies. Some of them were blind. It was cool because we could talk with one another clear across the country. But some of them used ham radio as a way of avoiding going out and getting jobs. All of this was before the internet and at a time when telegrams went through Western Union and long distance telephoning was considered terribly expensive. My buddy said, "We handle emergency messages. We send free telegrams as a public service. We do phone patches for people who can't afford long distance calls. This is the thing that we do in lieu of a job." And that scared me, because these were bright people. They didn't go out and do what I wanted to do. What they did would not earn them or me a paycheck, would not secure for me the respect of my family, and would not do justice to the work ethic we lived by, the rehabilitation contract I had committed myself to fulfill. I kept getting this message that you can do anything you want to do. You'll be different than those other blind folks that you see out there. I clung to that message, hoping it was true, but having little evidence to support that hope. One Christmas, my folks got me a guitar, and it turned out that I have some musical aptitude. Not very much, but some. As an example, I can hear a note and usually tell what that note is, which meant I learned to play by ear. Having that kind of talent serves you really well as an amateur, but not so much as a professional. But that wasn't how my father thought about it. If I had this kind of talent, we had suddenly figured out what I could do for a living. To me, music was just fun, was just cool. I mean, just to be able to play some kind of instrument I could carry with me. But to Dad, it was our salvation. For the longest time, many days when he got home, he would say, "Did you practice your guitar today?" Sometimes the answer was yes, but more often than not, it was no or not much or just a little. If he noticed that I was shy and uncomfortable playing in front of others, he knew the cure. He would make me come out and sing in public. I'd have to play for company, at school events, and at talent shows. I dreaded it. I hated it. It turned the music I loved into something that could make me sick to my stomach. Now, I can stand and talk without breaking a sweat, something you probably are regretting right now. But if you make me play the guitar and sing for you, I'll start to sweat, to shake, my voice will drop in volume, and I'll start to feel physically sick. So, if you're ready for an end to this speech, bring on the guitar and we'll be done with it. One night, my father and I were out in a fishing boat. It was late, quiet, we were by ourselves, and we were waiting for the fish to bite. Out of the blue comes the dreaded question, the one I'd been hearing for more than a year. "So, Gary, did you practice your guitar this week?" I said, "Well, no, not much." "Not much?" "Well, no, not really at all." He shifted his weight in the boat and said, "All right, Gary, I ask you every week if you've practiced your guitar, and mostly your answer is no, or some, or not very much. So, son, you're 16 years old now, and soon high school will be over. I want to ask you this. If you don't learn to sing and play that damned guitar, just what in the hell are you going to do for a living? Now, that almost scared me to death, even more than the toothpaste on my lips. For you see, I knew what kind of musical talent I had, thanks to the treachery of the tape recorder. I did not sound in anything at all like the people I wanted to emulate. I did not have the 3.5-octave voice range of Glen Campbell. I did not have the songwriting ability or the guitar skills of James Taylor. But what really scared me was that I pinned almost all of my hopes for a bright future on the fact that my father, above all people, had told me, "You can do anything." And I found out that evening in the boat that he had no more idea what I could do than I did. Now, the fact that none of us knew what I might do for a living didn't lessen the family pressure that I would go out and get a job. If you were going to be something, you had to work, you had to pull your own weight. But if my only option was to be a musician, there would be no chance for me to shine or to gain the respect of the people I loved, not to mention my own respect. Now, my wife tells me that I approached this musician business all wrong. She said that she had none of this apprehension when it came to her own musical talent. She said, "Your mistake was that you practiced using a microphone. If you had sung into a hairbrush like I did, you wouldn't have had any of those self-doubts." So when I started looking at career options, I ruled out musician. Though I went to church, I ruled out being a preacher because I didn't have the calling. I looked at a career in radio and realized that most people who worked in it at the time made about $75 a week, and that only the really good ones, the anchormen and the network broadcasters, made $100,000 a year. It wasn't that I needed $100,000 a year, but I certainly needed a lot more than $75 a week. I latched on to some other ideas that I began to share with people I knew when I got involved in the Federation. One of those people was a man named Carl Slavens. I told him I was toying with the idea of being a writer and said, "You know, I think I have figured out that my next project is to write a book about my life. I'm 16. He tried to suppress a chuckle and said, "You're going to write a book about your life? You're 16, right? Let me suggest that when you do something in your life worth writing about, you then worry about writing that book." Now, I can't tell you whether at that moment I loved or hated that man. Maybe I held both of those emotions simultaneously, because you see, I really thought that I was something worth writing a book about. Besides, a book might pay something and might lead to a career. I hated that he was laughing at the idea that someone would want to read a book about me, the bicycle rider, the horseback rider, the motorcycle rider, the fellow who actually learned to wash his face after he brushed his teeth. But at the same time, I loved that man too, because what he said was suggesting that I could eventually live a life worth writing about. I liked that. I clung to it. Maybe my book did not have to be about Gary the blind hero, but Gary, the man who could complete something in the world in the same way that sighted people did. So where does the Federation come on into all of this? I learned about the Federation because of a television show. Believe it or not, the show was called The Wonderful World of Color. It was a Disney series. The episode was called Atta Girl Kelly, and it was about a blind man's journey to get a seeing eye dog. I decided that I wanted to know more about those dogs than that little television show would tell me. I asked around and found a couple of fellows who had guide dogs, and one was actually willing to talk to me. His name was Jim Counts. He was an old fellow, by which I mean compared to me. He was probably as old then as I am now, so I don't know what that means. I called him up, and he talked with me about guide dogs for a while. After we talked a bit about the fantastic animals he had been partnered with, he would say, "Now you know, Gary, it's real important if you get a guide dog that you do obedience. Even when I go to conventions of the National Federation of the Blind, which is the largest organization of blind people in the country, we draw people from everywhere, you know." And then he'd go off on this tangent, and then he'd get back to guide dogs and tell me how you make the dog sit, lie down, and fetch, and all that sort of thing. Then I'd say, "Well, what about grooming?" "Oh, it's important that you groom them. They must always look their best, especially when you go to a convention of the National Federation of the Blind and see senators and representatives and important people in business. Yes, your dog must look his best, but because you are representing all blind people when you were a part of this organization." He just went on and on about this federation, and finally I got tired of it. I was hearing way too much about federation and way too little about guide dogs. I suggested to him, I said, "You know, you're a very busy man being in the office supply business. Maybe you could give me the name of somebody else that I could talk with, you know, take some of the burden off of you. I just want to know so much about guide dogs, and I don't want to wear you out." He saw through that, of course. He said, "Yeah, I know. You'd probably like to talk with somebody who's a little closer to your own age. I've got this fellow, and his name is Melvin Lewis," he said. He gave me Melvin's number, and I hung up the phone and smiled to myself. I thought, this is the end of this federation baloney. I'm going to get guide dog 24/7. So I call this Melvin Lewis, and I learned that he is indeed a young law student who has a German Shepherd dog named Belle, and he's all interested in telling me about her. Then he starts talking with me about how, if I want to see Belle, I should come to see him. See him at a meeting of the National Federation of the Blind of Kansas City. Turns out he was the chapter president. I wanted to see the dog, but there had to be something easier than going to see a group of blind people. But the more I talked with him, the more I realized that he was firm in setting the conditions under which I'd see his dog. He said, "You really ought to come." "Well, I don't have any transportation." "I'll get you transportation," he said. "Well, Friday night's bad for me." I should have anticipated the next question. "What do you normally do on Friday night?" "Well, watch television." That didn't buy me much. "Look, man, we have donuts and coffee, and you'll have a good time at the meeting." Well, coffee, donuts, that did it. "Okay, if you're going to give me a ride, I'll come to the meeting. Will the dog really be there? And what kind of donuts are they?" I attended the meeting, and I saw the dog, and I ate the donuts, and I wasn't that impressed with the Federation. But I was really impressed with Melvin Lewis. I respected him. He was doing something I might want to do. More important, he was showing me that I could be something other than a musician or a stay-at-home ham radio operator. Still, I was bored at the meetings and wondered if there was a better way to get this Melvin Lewis fellow without the Federation involvement. But when those wise old Federation members realized I might leave because I was bored, they elected me to an office, playing on my ego and my sense of guilt. They elected me as the corresponding secretary. Now, in that chapter, this was a do-nothing job, but if I had a job, I thought I had to come to the meetings. My having an elected position made people like Melvin Lewis proud of me, and I wanted them to be proud of me in the same way that I was proud of them. one thing led to another, and soon, pretty darn soon, I got involved in the Federation at the state and national level. I started to meet people who told me that my narrow outlook about how I couldn't do anything if I couldn't be a musician or a preacher or a radio disc jockey was very limiting. They actually had this radical proposition that you could do the average job in the average place of business with the right training and the opportunity. And that they said that this not only applied to them, but to me. They told me they knew where I could get the training. They would do their best to see that I had the opportunity. What amazed me about these blind people was that they were people who were movers and shakers, just like my father. And I wanted to grow up to be like my father, blind or not. Kenneth Jernigan was a mover and a shaker. He could put somebody up on the stage. They could give their speech. He could reveal it for the hogwash that it was. And he could do it politely but firmly. And I thought, wow, that guy's like my father, except a little more polite. And that guy is blind. This is wonderful. Now, one of the questions the Federation made me ask and answer was fundamental. As a blind person, was I shafted or was I challenged? They made me come to believe that I was challenged. And if it turned out I was shafted, that would be my own doing. So how have I fared? Well, my dad likes to tell the story that I told earlier about how he'd had to take care of me for the rest of his life. And the truth is, financially, I'm probably better off now than my other brothers and sisters, because being blind gave me a shot at a college education. It gave me a shot at materials that they've never had the chance to read. It gave me something wonderful and beneficial, this contract between rehabilitation and blind people. Now, I'm not famous, I'm not rich. There is not much chance that I'm going to be immortalized in history. But I have my own family of four. I have a good job, on most days a great job, where I'm trusted, respected, and appreciated. In real life, it doesn't get much better than that. I pay my taxes. I complain about my taxes, just like everybody else. It's a pretty darn good thing for a guy who was afraid he might end up doing nothing but living off those taxes. I love the Federation because it helped give me the life that I have, the education that I have, the rehabilitation that I have, the belief that I can do my job and be a contributing part of society. Since the Federation had done all of this for me, I eventually concluded that I had no choice but to pay back those who did so much work for me. Not only was I going to try to pay back, but I also wanted to pay it forward. I want people to have it at least as good as I've had it, and even better if we can manage it. I thank God for the life I have. I thank my parents for the life that I have. I thank the Federation for the life I have. I thank America for the life I have, which is the reason that I can never be a cynic about government, even when I see its problems. Last but not least, I thank you fine people for caring enough to give, for daring enough to engage in a cause larger than yourselves, and last but not least, for patiently sitting through all of this speech. You are the greatest, and I thank you for letting me be a part of your team. Thank you.